The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So in the last many weeks that I've been speaking here, I haven't really taken time at the end for questions or discussion. And I thought this evening might be nice to see if there's anything lingering from the talks over the last while or anything else that anybody would like to ask. It's nice for me to hear what's actually on your minds. And rather than thinking I know what you want. So I wonder, is there any questions or anything, concerns around this practice that we do that interests any of you? Highlight the things. I talked a lot about how important it is to be mindful. Yes, there's a...
I just wanted to comment more than question that I really appreciate the opportunity that we had, I don't remember if it was last week or the week before, to share with each other, and we didn't have the opportunity to actually do the ritual that you described, but that would be lovely too. It really, the group of four that I participated in, we all kind of shared that it was really helped us. Even though it was just one evening and kind of a small activity, that it helped to build community, and that we all felt that was really valuable and important. So I just wanted to
thank you, share that.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I appreciate hearing that. And I feel it's important to periodically do that for the community's sake and so we learn from each other. And there was a time where I thought we should do that once in every sixth week, sixth Monday or something. But what happens is that I think one of the hesitations I have around doing it is sometimes this room is so full, and it just feels a little bit unmanageable to do that with it just so full. But I thought last week I hit upon this great idea, I thought, which was to have you huddle really close, encourage you so you can talk as quietly as you could. And it wasn't that bad in here. It wasn't as loud as it had been sometimes. So I agree we should do it more often. One of the places at IMC where we do it often, that kind of activity for those who can't come, is once a month, usually on Friday, we have these Dharma practice days. And those Dharma practice days has a lot of that, a lot of discussion, a lot of going to small groups. And so it's a very significant place for sharing yourself, sharing your understanding of the practice, sharing how you're managing through it around some particular topic. And then hearing how other people are doing and their concerns, and that's. Thank you.
So I've been wondering about.
Check one.
I've been wondering about how to tell the difference between projection and kind of knowing what's going on in a situation with maybe another person or a group of people. And I never really thought that much about projection and what it is. And off the top of my head, I can't think of a great example, but it seems like it's really confusing sometimes, like you're projecting, but your projection is right, maybe, or like, you know, but...
What's a right projection? Sometimes right, there are shared projections. So, for example, a few years ago, I remember they changed the street signs or something, or the laws or rules around certain streets here in Redwood City. And I was visiting some place, you know, part of town where I hadn't been for a long time, and I hadn't noticed that they had changed the what you could do there. And now it said you couldn't make a U-turn in that intersection. But I didn't notice. So I made a U-turn, and I guess a lot of people must do it because there was a police car just waiting for that to happen. He was just sitting there, you know, waiting, you know. And so he pulled me over, and the projection I had was that very clearly was, this is a police officer. If I'd seen the same person out of uniform, or even as in uniform, but not having just made an illegal U-turn, I probably wouldn't have projected as much onto him, or, you know, and I think he wanted me to project onto him. And it was very effective, the way I assumed that who he was and how to treat him, because he said, well, don't do it again. And then I said, oh, but before you go, I'd like to ask you some questions. And so then I said, I'm a minister in Redwood City, and I have some questions about how things work here. And he was quite happy to talk to me for a while. But, you know, I called myself a minister. And I don't do that very often. But if I said I was a Buddhist meditation teacher, the projection wouldn't have been as favorable, I thought. It was like, we have this, this training program we do here called Introduction to Buddhist Chaplaincy. That is a year-long program. People want to be chaplains in hospitals and prisons and things like that. And one of the first years we did it, there was this guy who was not from Redwood City. He was in the class, and he was late to the class, and he was coming down Farm Hill. You know, for those of you from Redwood City, know that Farm Hill coming down the hill there is often a speed trap. The police are just sitting there waiting for people to speed down that long grade. So the policeman pulled him over, and he said, where are you going? And he said, I'm going to my chaplaincy training. And the police officer says, well, I can't give a minister a ticket. So he let him go. So there's all kinds of projection. Projection means that we paint, we look through the lens or through the picture of something when we look at someone. And some of them are accurate in the sense that they're conventions that we're supposed to share, like, you know, police officer, you're usually better off sharing that convention. But it's just a role that people are playing, and so we see the person through that role. If you have a parent, and you know, who has maybe had a difficult time with your parent, and then you see someone else who looks like your parent, and then you see your parent in that person, then it's sometimes called a particular kind of projection called transference. And so we all sometimes carry with us old ideas or other associations that we put on things. So, you know, in my life, I had to deal with projections having to do with authority. When I was younger, I tended to be somewhat inhibited or intimidated, I guess the word, intimidated around authority figures. And so I had to kind of look at that very carefully and see how, when I saw someone who was an authority figure, what I was painting them with, or the issues that came up in my mind, and how I was seeing them when it was going on. And what's, I think, very helpful if you do meditation practice, any kind of practice that gets your mind relatively still, or practice that gets your mindfulness quite sharp. It's really great when you can do both of those things, have the mind somewhat still and calm, and the mindfulness very strong. You can see the movements of the mind as they occur. You can see the thoughts, the ideas, the beliefs that bubble up in the mind. And so you could see someone walking down the street, and you see there's a person, and then the next moment you can see that there's an idea that bubbles up in your mind, that person is X. And so now, you know, the person's just a person, but now we've painted the person, we've covered the person over, we've projected onto that person something, some idea that we have. And it may or may not be accurate. But it's very significant to be able to see it happening in the mind. Because if you can see it happening, then you have some choice about how much to act on it. Or how maybe you should look more carefully. If you, well, I don't know, maybe that's not, that's, maybe that's an interpretation, maybe I should look more carefully and see if it's really the case. And so, but often what happens is that the ideas we have about people or situations are so quick that we assume that we are, what we think is what's really going on. And sometimes it is, but sometimes it isn't. But the one of the very effective ways of questioning it or looking more deeply is to have the mindfulness sharp enough you can watch your mind produce the idea. Do you want to ask something more? So I can try to answer your question?
Well, that's helpful, but I sometimes feel I get caught in getting angry, but then and then I'll make the outside world much worse than it is, like, to it, and I'm just never quite sure. I guess it gets kind of confusing with projection, like maybe there's something in the outside world that I have to see, but I also have to see my anger and like how to balance those two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you know you're angry, then it's good to take that seriously. I think that anger should be respected. And anger is a very important clue, or a very important movement within us. And one way to respect it is to look at it carefully, to be very careful not to make any decisions or act on the anger, but to look at it more carefully and turn towards it and find some way to soften the edges of it so that it's not in charge, but you are. And one of the effective ways of doing that is sitting in meditation and sitting quietly with your anger and recognize there's anger here. And and just sit with it, keep recognizing, keep seeing it. And if you keep looking at it and seeing it, as opposed to being it, as opposed to falling into it, the fuel for it is not going to keep feeding it, it's not going to keep being building. And it'll start softening around the edges, you start getting some distance from it, you start finding you're a little bit free of it. And then once you're free, yeah, maybe it'll even go away and soften. And then you can look at the situation with fresh eyes, because the anger won't be there. So I wouldn't, so if you can, when you're angry, I think it's really good to take time out and do the work of somehow softening the edges of the anger and not being caught in it, and then going back and looking at the situation. If you do that a lot, if you do that regularly and develop that, then at some point you'll learn enough about anger that you can do it in a moment. You can do it in the situation itself. You can take a deep breath and you can kind of soften it and not be caught by it, and then maybe kind of see the situation not through the lens of the anger. But the first thing to do is to if you recognize your anger, learn to stop for it. Breathe, soften, relax. Because if you try to kind of stay being angry, somehow just kind of let the anger kind of chug along freely without you stopping and paying attention to it, then you're trying to fix it, understand it, deal with the situation through the perspective of the anger itself, you're probably like in a maze you won't get out of. Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about meditating when you don't feel well? So I have a tendency, like if I get a cold or something, I like so afraid to meditate because, you know, I'm having like head pain or I'm, you know, I don't know. I just, that's not a good,
I just stop practicing for whatever, then I'm ill. So I just thought it would be interesting.
What's the fear about?
I think it's the so much physical discomfort for me. I think that's the...
Oh, so you're afraid of the discomfort?
Yes, that mm-hmm. much discomfort. You know, it's not a discomfort that comes and goes. Uh-huh. It's, you know, that much discomfort.
Beautiful.
Constantly, maybe.
That's great. It's a great opportunity. You should see it as... You should really, you should see it as an opportunity because, you know, to only be mindful when you think you can use a mindfulness to overcome something, then you won't deal with the deeper issues of your relationship to what's happening. And when you can't overcome something, some problem, you know, there's two elements to the equation. There's the issue and there's you. And one of those has to change. So if you can't change the issue, guess who has to change? And so sometimes looking, you know, having some, forcing you to change something inside of yourself, seeing, learning something about yourself is really a really good thing. And if there's any way out to use mindfulness to get better, then you don't have to change yourself. So what is it you have to learn about your resistance to discomfort, your fear of it, your annoyance, your anger? You know, what goes on with you in relationship to discomfort? How can you learn to be comfortable with discomfort? How can you learn to maybe there's a lot of ideas you project onto the discomfort. When I'm uncomfortable, then I'm a failure. I'm doing something wrong when I'm so uncomfortable. Or maybe there's attitudes, this is too hard, I'm not up to it. And so there's all this doubt that comes into play. Or there's a kind of shutting down that goes on, we get numb kind of because just... So kind of to study what goes on when difficulties, you know, seemingly don't change is a very powerful place to practice.
Yeah, that's very helpful because it doesn't happen in something like childbirth or something painful like that. Like, it's not pain. It's, like you said, associations around, you know, I'm sick and I can't do what I need to do, or, you know, it's all the relationships, I think.
So I would encourage you to, even if you feel like you don't want to, that's the times you really should practice. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot to just be present for and learn about as you're there. And it might take a few rounds of sickness to kind of find your way. I find that it's often very nice. I find I actually like to meditate when I'm sick. In a conventional way, the meditation is a bust. I mean, you know, it's not like I get deeply concentrated or still or all that. But what I do is I feel very close and intimate when I'm this way. And it forces me into my body and forces me. It's sometimes very easy to be present, because you know, it's the present moment is demanding. And what I do when I'm sick is that I spend a lot of time doing mindfulness in my body, and then and relaxing. So I add to the mindfulness the practice of softening and relaxing my muscles. So just sitting up and just seeing what I can relax and soften, and kind of letting my attention kind of go into deep into my muscles and seeing it kind of soften. And that somehow I feel that's healing to do that, letting the mind become still. There are times when I've been sick, really sick, where it was very interesting to watch the effect my thinking had on the sickness, that if I thought certain thoughts, my energy would drain out, I would drop, I'd feel more sick. And I had other kind of thoughts, that wouldn't happen. I didn't have thoughts that made me feel better. But I could certainly have thoughts that made me feel worse. And so I learned I had to track what I was thinking and not allow myself to think thoughts of self-pity and, you know, catastrophe thinking and all kinds of ways in which, you know, I just find it made it worse. And I've seen this. Once I saw the same thing when I had my back go out, something horrible. And I could barely walk without, you know, I take half-inch steps and kind of waddle around, and you know, I thought every step I felt that it's going to break in half my back. It just felt terrible. And then also I could, in that kind of dire, kind of extreme kind of pain, I could also watch my mind and see the effect that thinking had. And it's very interesting to see, because most of us are usually healthy enough that you know, we don't see the consequence of the effect that thinking has on our system. So I think it's good. And sometimes when I'm also very sick and I can't sit up to meditate, I'll do it lying down. And that has the benefit that sometimes I fall asleep. And which, when I'm sick, I think is probably good. So over here.
Kind of new at meditating, and there seems to be a very fine line between when I'm meditating and falling asleep.
Yes.
So I thought I'd ask. I mean, when I'm more, like tonight, I was on the edge. I practically fell over. But I like to watch the thoughts that are going through my mind. It's really fascinating. I love it. But I don't know. I'm still confused. Am I asleep or am I meditating?
One of the common effects of meditation is that people get calm. And as people get calm, it's very easy to get too calm and kind of start drifting off into sleep. Most people only close their eyes if they're going to go to sleep. So if you close your eyes when you meditate, then you get calm. Sometimes the system is set up to kind of move you into sleepy states. And often when the meditation is, when you're somewhat calm and relaxed in the meditation, for some people also find that their thoughts become kind of pleasant, and kind of pleasant, kind of drifting thoughts, which are kind of alluring and also or soporific, those thoughts, and kind of seduce you into kind of drifting off even more. And so it's called, sometimes this is called sinking mind. The mind, the energy, the alertness of the mind sinks. And so it's generally not useful to fall asleep when you meditate. But it's not necessarily bad to fall asleep. It means that you're relaxed. It's nice to be relaxed. Some people need sleep more than need meditation. So, you know, maybe that's good. And it's very important for people who meditate regularly to become cognizant, aware, recognize when you start having the sinking mind. When you're getting calm, and so the alertness, you might feel, sometimes the calm feels really good, and if you think the purpose of meditation is to get calm, some people are seduced by that calm to drift off into the sinking mind. But calm is useful, but at least when we do mindfulness practice, we're not focusing on calm as an end. We're focusing on alertness or clarity, the ability to clearly see what's happening in the present moment. So people who do mindfulness need to watch and learn to recognize when the mind begins to drift off, the sinking mind begins happening, and then to sharpen up the mental muscle, kind of somehow sit up straighter, maybe use the mental noting, or maybe try to emphasize a little bit more clarity in the inner eye that sees, or the inner sense that feels, or see with more exactitude. What is actually going on here as I breathe in, as I breathe out? Or be more diligent and let go of your thoughts. Somehow arouse more energy so that you have just the right balance. So it's a common phenomena and something people have to learn to work with. And sometimes it's sleepiness like this also is a temporary phenomena. At least I don't know a lot of people who talk about this. I know for myself that when I meditate, sometimes in the end of the day, like when I used to work at a kind of tiring job, I would meditate for 40 minutes when I came home around 5:30, and I found that the first 20 minutes I was nodding off a lot, and then I'd wake up and then I'd be crystal clear, and I think I was just kind of sloughing off the tiredness of the day. And I don't want to say I was taking a nap, but it was useful to kind of slough off something or let something settle. So that's what I think. So I'm right in the back, all the way in the back. There has to be a green light.
I often find that I'm sleepy, and as you were just describing there, you know, would struggle with falling asleep when meditating. It's been the case maybe the last couple of weeks I've come here. Today I read something about the benefits of naps in the afternoon, so I took a nap. Then I had several cups of tea in the afternoon, so I was quite awake and struggled more with just, I guess, what I've heard called monkey mind, just, you know, thoughts just keep bouncing up and, you know, falling the thoughts and coming back to the breath to try to come back to meditation. And it just occurred to me that when you said we talk a lot about the benefits of meditation, the benefits of insight practice. I mean, I just thought that as poorly as I often do it, it still has some benefit to me, because just sitting for a while as I did tonight, I feel more calm. I realized that I felt somewhat agitated coming in before I got here, and you know, something changed a bit. So, you know, I just appreciate that it, you know, how well it works even when not done perfectly. Thank you.
Beautiful. It's nice to hear that. And there's not a question there, but I'd like to add this to what you said, both with sleepiness and monkey mind, is that it's often important to appreciate that whatever's going on in our meditation, there's what's going on, and then there's our relationship to what's going on. And sometimes what's important to work with is not necessarily what's going on, the sickness or the sleepiness or the anxiety or the monkey mind, but rather is to look at our relationship to it. So the relationship means our attitude, means the thoughts, the ideas, the emotions, the feelings we have of what's going on. So someone might have a monkey mind, anxious mind jumping around, thinking a lot, and get really discouraged because, this is not what meditation is supposed to be about. Meditation is supposed to be about getting really still and floating on a cloud, they think. And this is not what's going on. Or they might feel angry at with themselves, or angry at the meditation, or angry at the Buddha, because, you know, obviously he didn't know what he was talking about. Because if he did, he would have said something helpful. Or it could be anxiety, or it could be embarrassment, or impatience that might arise. There's a lot of things that happen in very interesting self-identity issues that come up. Well, I think I'm supposed to be the best meditator in my block, but this is threatening my self-image here. So it can be very interesting to look at how we relate to it, and rather than trying to fix the sickness, the sleepiness, the monkey mind, see, can we be at peace with it? Can we not be wrapped up around it or reactive to it? And so then to develop more patience around it. So that's one thing just that occurred to me as I heard you speaking, the importance of looking at how we relate to things. So in front of you, here, you pass the mic.
Do you think it's ever skillful to take a break from practice? Like if the mind is a muscle and runners take a break because they run every day for 6 months and their whole body hurts, if you've been practicing for...
Your mind hurts?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a number of times that I suggest people take breaks. I think that if... sometimes if people are really into it and have been practicing a lot of meditation for a few years, even 6 months sometimes, I say, it's an interesting exercise to stop for a week or two. And see what happens, because sometimes if you practice every day, the benefits, get normalized. Or they sneak up on us, and we don't really see, obviously, the benefits, because it becomes kind of ordinary part of our life. But if you take a week off from meditation, sometimes you'll see much more clearly what the benefits are. And you say, wow, you know, now I'm much more anxious in the day, or I'm much more jumpy, or... So the day doesn't work as smoothly as before when I was meditating, and now I see how important meditation is. So sometimes stopping is a way of gauging, you know, what the benefits actually are, how useful it is, because you don't get that benefits anymore. That's one thing. Another reason to stop is some people are a little bit too, zealous around this meditation thing. I mean, it does happen occasionally, right? You have people go a little bit overboard in their attachment to Buddhism and all it's going to do for them. And so sometimes when I've seen that, I've suggested people take a break. And remember, I told one man this. I forget what I told him, but I told him he'd been practicing diligently, seriously for years. Beautiful man, beautiful practice. And I told him, why don't you stop for a couple of months? And he started crying. So it was kind of very touching to see his tears. But I thought it was very important because I touched a nerve. He'd invested too much into it. And by giving him that exercise to stop for a while, he could see that how much was maybe the attachments that were there. And then some people, the way they practice is not so balanced. So some people are straining a lot when they meditate. They try too hard. They think meditation is about batting away the thoughts or batting away the emotions they don't like or something, and or repressing things, or they're just trying desperately not to feel something by just being present on the breath, or they're trying, you know, they're straining to be the, you know, to not miss one single breath, to develop perfect concentration. And so, whatever reason, some people try too hard in a way that's straining. And that's not healthy, not helpful. And sometimes it's good to stop meditating so that to break that habit or try to get a different perspective. So, in terms of a muscle getting sore, if you exercise too much and comparing that to meditation, I think that's only true if there's something off about the way the person is trying to meditate, the effort they're making in meditation. If the effort is appropriate effort, I don't think anything is going to get tired. So it might be interesting for you to look at what kind of effort you're making. And rather than stopping to meditate, maybe experiment, are there other ways of meditating that are maybe more relaxing or useful?
How important when an emotion comes up is it to label it? And the reason that I ask is that lately I've been experimenting when an emotion comes up, really trying to go to a wordless place and just feel it without words. And I'm really struck by how much more deeply I feel it without labeling it. And I'm just curious if it is important to label it.
The labeling that we do, the mental noting, is a particular technique that some people find are helpful that augments or supports the mindfulness practice. And it's not required to do the mental noting. Some people find it very helpful. Some people find that it's not helpful at all. Some people find it's helpful in certain circumstances and not helpful in other circumstances. So the people who do use mental noting, I call mental noting or labeling an art. And it takes a while to learn the art of it and know when it's useful and when it's not. So, for example, some people find it useful when the mind is really agitated or busy, the monkey mind is there. The labeling is kind of like stabilizing it, kind of like, it's kind of like a little bit like taking a stand rather than running around. You know, here I am, this is what's happening. So it's going to be settling while the mind is really agitated. But once the mind is concentrated, or somewhat calm, then perhaps the mental noting stirs the pot even more, makes it, you know, and you're better off letting go of it and then hearing it silently, what's going on. And so it's really a matter of trial and error, all this thing. So try the labeling. If labeling doesn't seem to be useful, then try the silent approach of feeling, being present. If that's useful, that makes you more connected and deeper. Then that's the answer. And then you do that for a while and find that's helpful, and then at some point you might find yourself kind of reached a plateau, and then you might find that if you take and soften the mental noting, make it a very, very soft little whisper in the mind. You can really, really, almost like you're not doing it at all, but just a little bit. Then it might help you to go further and go deeper. So it's something, you know, it's a variety of things, and so it's a trial and error. Yes.
I've been struggling with the idea of contentment versus discontentment, because you know, there's the idea of contentment. Maybe is that like resting on your laurels and not doing much, or and also in the past I've noticed sometimes discontentment has pushed me forward, sort of into a better place, and so I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
It's a good question, and you have to be careful with a question like that, not to set up kind of some one idea of what contentment is versus one idea of what discontentment is, and to put them opposed to each other. There are some things which are in life where it's useful to be content about them, and some things which are useful to be discontented about. Some things which are not useful to be contented with, and which are, and some things which are not useful to be discontented with. So it depends on what's, you know, what's going on. You have to kind of evaluate carefully. So for example, the Buddha said it's very useful to be contented with having the basic necessities of life. So to have just the necessary shelter, the necessary livelihood, the necessary food, the necessary clothes to wear, and be content with that, as opposed to looking at your neighbor's car and thinking, you know, it's fine. You know, I have this car that works; it gets me around just fine, but it's kind of old, and my neighbor has a Tesla, and so now I'm discontented with my car. That kind of discontent, the Buddha say, is actually, you know, is not really so useful to have. It's for someone who wants to practice and wants to devote themselves to finding some inner peace and freedom. You're better off being contented with things like the basic necessities of life and not getting agitated by looking for all these other things you can do and have and acquire and things like that. They say, you know, so it's also an area of contentment. It's said to be, if you're married or have a committed relationship, is to be contented in the relationship and not, you know, to go looking for somewhere else for sexual relationships, for example. That's considered useful. To be contented with your suffering, you know, I'm just suffering and anxious, and, you know, I don't have to go to this day long on Saturday and anxiety. I'm just happily anxious, and, you know, I wake up at night and headaches, that's fine, and I don't seem to sleep very well. I'm always stumbling at work because, you know, making mistakes because I'm so anxious, but, you know, I'm content. You know, that's kind of silly. So then Buddhism says it's important to be discontented with some things. So to be discontented with your suffering is what will propel you to become free of it. So the question is, you know, you find that discontent propels you to do things in life. Are those things useful pursuits or not? And from the point of view of, you know, this the path, the Eightfold Path, the path of practice, you know, what is it that's useful to be contented with to support your engagement on the path, and what things are useful to be discontented with that support you on the path is the guideline for how to find your way. Make sense? Yeah.
More consistent I am with the meditation and reading the meditations and coming here, I've really let go of a lot of self-judgment. I really, really let go of a lot of, whole lot of stuff. I think I was just really ready for it. And so when this time came, I've just been letting go and let go, let go. So my question, and so I'm really very much at peace with myself and really self-accepting and feeling really good about myself. But I have this one problem. I have a family member that I'm
that I love with all my heart that is so self-righteous. She is the judge and the jury of everybody. And I find myself, like, for example, this weekend, I'm going over there, and on the drive down there, because she's all the way down in San Jose, I'm thinking about how I'm going to handle all of this stuff, how I'm going to deal with it. And it isn't coming really natural yet, because I'm finding I have more and more of a distaste for that. I mean, or I notice it more, or something, because I'm not doing it myself so much. But I don't know how to deal with that self-righteousness that comes at me.
So you don't have some of it too?
Well, not like I. Well, probably. I don't know. I just think not like I used to. I guess you know. So
I think it's so. You might, since you're doing such a good job with yourself.
Well, I think I am.
I believe you. I would begin by looking at yourself even more, and see what goes on inside of you in relationship to this relative. And what makes you upset? What makes you angry? Why do you get so uncomfortable being around this person when they're being the judge? Because maybe there's something further for you to let go of, so that you can be in present and just, it's like, you know, it's just like the birds singing in the trees when, you know, when that relative kind of makes the judgments. You don't have to buy into it, or you don't have to, you know. It's like listening to.
That's it. I'm still buying in, not always, but sometimes. Yeah, yeah, it depends. And it's almost like, if I don't buy into it, don't buy into it, don't buy into it, then finally by the end of the day, I'm done. And then I buy into it, right?
Yeah. So I would study yourself. Okay. And if you know, that piece of information is interesting. So what it might tell you is that maybe you shouldn't spend so long uninterrupted time with a person. And, you know, you do your practice, be present, be mindful, watch yourself, let go, stay empty as best you can in a beautiful. And then, but you know you can do it for 2 hours. After 2 hours, you say, please, you know, I need to go to the bathroom. And most people want to ask you what you're doing in the bathroom. And what you're doing is going to meditate. And then they ask you, you were there for a long time. You can say, yes, it took a while to come out. they don't have to know it. So that's one thing. And then there's also, so that's just deal with yourself, and maybe that's enough. Sometimes if you can find your peace with that and not be caught by it, sometimes a person somehow indirectly changes as well. That might be, maybe not. But also, there's also talking to the person directly. I mean, doing something about it. And so I've been in situations like that, and there's a number, depending on the person's situation, I've tried different things. One thing I tried to do is simply not participate in those conversations. So they bring it up, and I'll change the subject. I say, oh, that's interesting, and, you know, and try to veer the conversation to something else, away from that. And sometimes that's been worked well. I take responsibility for, or set the direction of the conversation whenever I feel like it's going someplace that's not good. Sometimes I've confronted the person directly and said, you know, I like coming to see you, but there is something I want to bring up and that makes it challenging when I'm with you, and that is that, you know, I don't know if you realize this, but you're often judging people a lot, and what happens to me is I feel like my energy drains when it's hard for me to be around that a lot. And because it's so hard for me, and I like to be with you, I wonder if there's some way we could, you know, maybe not talk that way so as often as we do, or can we modify, or can I, you know, call for a timeout, or.
Yeah, what's interesting is, you know, these little comments can come from other places, and they don't bother me. It's just mostly one person.
Yeah, so study yourself. Yeah. Study what goes on. Sometimes with relatives, you know, sometimes we identify really closely with them, and because it's kind of like us almost, and so we get pulled in. So I would look at yourself, and you, I believe you're doing great work in letting go. Take it one step further. Okay, so we started off this evening with you saying how much you appreciated hearing each other in group of four. So for me, having you ask questions is my way of hearing you this way and finding out what's going on out there. So I appreciate it. I hope it was interesting or useful for the rest of you as well. And I wish you all a wonderful week. And I guess tomorrow is the longest day. So enjoy the day. And if you do get up and meditate in the morning, it's kind of sweet to sit early in the morning when things are still quiet and still, but the light is out. So thank you all.